You know, the work of ministry is never boring. There are soaring heights and there are agonizing lows. We see people's lives transformed. We see incredible growth. We see victorious breakthroughs. We are midwives to spiritual birth. We enjoy the glory of new faith and baptisms and reconciliation and new life. But from these glorious heights, we often then find ourselves down in the valley. We see people's brokenness and sin and disobedience and pain. We walk with people through sickness and loss and death. And we face cutting criticism, betrayal, loneliness, a sense of failure. A spiritual leader experiences both glorious highs and devastating lows. There are days when I know that I have the best job in the world. I have watched as the fire of God's presence falls, so to speak, and lives have been changed, and it's the most incredible privilege in the world to be witness to it. And there are days when I am so low that I just want to quit. And I would quit if I had any skills whatsoever and could do anything else in the world. But it hurts too much. The failure's too great. I can't accomplish what I set out to do. I can't overcome the sin in people's lives. They won't repent. They won't believe. They won't change. What have I even done? Is it even worth it? Like, has it been worth all this effort? What do I have to show for my years of work? And I fall into a hopeless despair. In pastoral ministry, we have a word for this. It's called Monday. There's sort of a rhythm of like the joys of Sunday and the depression of Monday. There's ups and there's downs in ministry and in life. You may be completely resonating with this, even if you've never served in ministry. Have you also faced this? Spiritual lows, spiritual highs. There are spiritual victories and breakthroughs and moments of God's presence and nearness and overcoming sin and seeing Him work in amazing ways. A friend is healed. Someone comes to faith in Jesus. These exciting moments, and you're like, everything's amazing. And then quickly followed by hopeless defeats and despair, frustration, failure. There's times in your life where God works so powerfully, and it's amazing. And there are times in your life where you have despaired and felt hopeless and overwhelmed. And sometimes those great mountain victories and those deep, dark valleys are only a short walk from each other. It's amazing how closely they can come together. And that's how it was for Elijah. His great mountaintop victory, this unbelievable story we're talking about thousands of years later, was quickly followed by a horribly dark valley. Mount Carmel seemed like this massive success, right? The fire of God fell. The prophets of Baal were defeated. God's people returned to him. It's like everything was amazing in that story. He had just then ran on ahead to Jezreel to announce the return of the king, the restoration of the covenant. Baal worship is over. Revival has come. And then it all comes crashing down so quickly, so quickly. Here's what happened. Look at the first verses of chapter 19. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's." Wow. From the victory of the mountain to the despair of the valley. Jezebel hears all that from Ahab, all that Elijah had done. And she's furious. She sends a messenger to Elijah saying, "I'm going to kill you by tomorrow. You're finished." I mean, she actually couldn't be more emphatic. Like, she calls upon a woe on her own self that the gods would kill her, right? So may the gods do to me and more if I do not make your life as one of them by tomorrow. Like, it couldn't be more emphatic, the threat against Elijah. And, yeah, I remember Jerry Seinfeld years ago making this joke. you go to the post office, so this is an old joke, right? Yeah, you go to the post office, and there's wanted posters of criminals at the post office. And he's like, here's an idea. Instead of taking their picture, why don't you come out from behind the camera and grab them? Like, they're there with you. Like, why are you letting them go? And I think that's kind of what's going on here. Like, why does she send a messenger? Why not send an army? Why warn him and send him away? Like, why not just go and get him if you know where he is? I think she might be afraid of Elijah. He just killed 450 of her prophets. She's probably, you know, wise enough to know she's kind of next in line here. I think she threatens him to make him leave so that he doesn't come for her next. Like, she just wants to get rid of him, so she threatens him like this. But Elijah, instead of being bold and courageous and standing his ground, he's terrified. He runs for his life. Beersheba is the southernmost city in the kingdom of Judah. So outside of Israel, now into the kingdom of Judah, and the furthest possible place within Israel and Judah that he could go. And he leaves his servant there, which suggests to me that he's done. He's done with ministry. He doesn't plan on returning. He's giving up. And then he travels a day's journey into the wilderness, sits down under a broom tree, and prays for his death. Broom tree is just a desert shrub indigenous to the Middle East. It provides shade in the wilderness. Now, why does he do all this? What's the point here? So in chapter 17, we remember God sent him out of Israel then, right? He sent him to the brook Cherith and to the town of Zarephath, right? It was a strategic departure. The prophetic word was being removed from Israel. And so it was a strategic command of God to remove Elijah from Israel and remove the prophetic voice as a punishment on Israel, on Ahab. But you know what? This is different. This is the first time in any of the chapters we've been reading about Elijah, I noticed that this is the first time that Elijah does something without God telling him to do it. Like, it's always been a word came from the Lord and he does it. Word came and he does it. He's never moved anywhere without God telling him to do it in the story, right? But this time there's no word. It's noticeably absent. There's no word from God here. He seems to be acting all on his own, running away, afraid and hopeless. He wasn't supposed to do this. I mean, he just prayed down fire from heaven and he's afraid? Yeah, he is. He's not just afraid, he's depressed and hopeless. His life is a failure. He wants to die. And for some people who are like, I don't believe it. Like, the God who called down fire from, or the man who called down fire from heaven is afraid of Jezebel. And that's where I say my phrase. Are you new to humans? this is what our story is too. We see amazing breakthroughs, and it's shortly followed by hopeless despair. We can flip-flop just like him. Elijah prays that God would take his life. He's just done. He's had enough. He's finished. And he says he's no better than his fathers. I think by that he means I'm no better at bringing revival, right? His prophetic role is a failure. Revival won't come. The prophets will all be killed. The worship of Yahweh will end with him. He'll be the last one. His fathers weren't able to bring revival, to return the people to worshiping God. He isn't either. He's no better than them. He thought he was. He's not. See, he's looking to himself and that he could do this. And he was wrong. And we find this so surprising. You know, after all that he's seen, why is he so afraid? And why is he running like this? After all that he's witnessed, the providence of God, the miracles of God, but he has hit the bottom of that dark, dark valley. Perhaps he believed that the war with Baal was over. Right? The king and the people had returned to God, and revival was at hand. The prophets of Baal were gone. This was the big defining turning point in their history of Israel. But then it was all dashed away the next day as Jezebel sought to kill him. He wasn't the success that he thought, and now he has nothing to show for his ministry. I mean, he called down fire from heaven, and it still wasn't enough. So he's hit this point of despair. It'll never be enough. I can't do it. I have failed. Elijah is suffering from spiritual depression, hopelessness, despair. It's not uncommon in ministry or in life in general. even after great successes, we can collapse into a state of hopelessness. Why? Why has this happened to Elijah? Well, let's reflect on it. There are many factors that could be playing a role that are combining to arrive at this moment. He was exhausted, physically exhausted. Think about the Carmel showdown and the stress and pressure and exhaustion of doing this spiritual battle with all these prophets. And then he sprints to Jezreel and then finds out his life is in danger and he flees again. So he's been busy. He's tired. He's exhausted. He was also isolated. He's been on his own for years. He lacks a team or a partner in ministry, a community to help him, someone to help him through hard days. Practically speaking, he's alone. He's alone in this, and that isolation can be so exhausting. He's drained after ministry, right? With the help of adrenaline, there's these amazing energy highs and then energy crashes, especially in ministry. And after the adrenaline high of Carmel, he's hit the wall. He's hit the adrenaline crash the next day. He's had dashed expectations, right? He seemed to hope that Baal worship is gone forever. We're free of this horrible thing. And the king would usher in a new season of faithfulness to God and obedience and covenant blessings. But as his hopes were soaring, I can't believe this happened, it crashed to the ground at the threat of Jezebel. Turns out, he realizes, you know, I turned the king. But it turns out the king doesn't run this country. His wife does. And she isn't repenting anytime soon. She's committed completely to worshiping Baal till death. And she's the one that really runs the country. I can see the repentance of the king and it won't do anything. And he was just straight up afraid. Fear. Jezebel had hunted and murdered many of God's prophets. And now she had fixed her eyes completely on him and swore revenge. He was afraid. He was afraid. All this collides together in this one moment, and Elijah gives up. He prays for death. He's finished. So how will God answer to his cry of pain? Verse 5. And he lay down and slept under a broom tree, and behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. Man, look at God's gentle response. I find it amazing. God doesn't answer Elijah's prayer the way he wanted and kills him. He doesn't take his life. He doesn't do it. Instead, he sends a messenger. Now, it's interesting because in English we have the word angel, we have the word messenger, but actually both in Hebrew and in Greek, they're actually the same word. It's just the word messenger. There's no word for angel separate from a messenger. An angel is just a messenger of God, and it's context that has to tell you that this is a spiritual angelic messenger, not a human messenger. And so God sends a messenger, and it's not until the second instance of the word messenger that we realize that it's a messenger from the Lord. And so Jezebel, same word, Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah announcing his impending death. And then God sends a messenger, same word, to strengthen and nourish him. And then we realize when the messenger comes again, it's a messenger of the Lord, and that this is God's gentle response. He feeds Elijah. So we have another miraculous provision of food in the wilderness, right? Again, echoing, Elijah is like Israel. He's being fed miraculously in the wilderness by God. He's living out Israel again. And these verses are filled with death and resurrection language and imagery, right? Elijah prays for his death and he lies down. You know, sometimes that language is euphemistically referencing death. And the messenger calls him to rise and nourishes him and restores life to him. This is Elijah's death and resurrection imagery. And that's kind of spiritually, what's emotionally, what's happening as the angel nourishes him and raises him back up. And I find this so encouraging. When Elijah is done and asking for death, and he's afraid, he's afraid, he's disobedient, and he's asking for death, what does God do? God sends him food, water, refreshment. God is tender and gentle to Elijah as he wallows in the valley. God is a gentle, compassionate, tender father who meets us in the valley. He doesn't shame us from the mountaintop. Get out of the valley. He comes down. He meets us in the valley. He gives us what we need to help us get out. Then Elijah journeys for 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. This is Mount Sinai. It's other name, right? So think about it. Elijah is doing the reverse journey of the wilderness wanderings of Israel. So after the Exodus, the people of Israel come out of the Exodus, cross the Red Sea. They come to Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, where, you know, remember this, Exodus 19 and beyond. They receive the Ten Commandments. They enter the covenant with God. They commit idolatry with the golden calf, all that. They build the tabernacle. And then they spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And eventually, they enter into the promised land, right? Elijah's doing the same thing backwards. He leaves the promised land, wanders in the same wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, and arrives at the mountain of God. He's undoing it. He's doing the journey in reverse. But why? Why does he do this? Why does Elijah go to the mountain? Did God send him there? Or does he go of his own desire? If he goes of his own desire, what does he think going to happen there? What's he trying to get from God at the mountain? Why would he go there? I think that God didn't send Elijah, that God didn't tell him to go. I think that Elijah's running to Mount Horeb on his own terms and for his own purposes. I think in his crisis, in his valley, he heads to the mountain where in the past God has revealed himself. Here's what happens when he arrives. Verse 9. There he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. It's the first time the word of the Lord comes in this passage. The word of the Lord came to him and said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So God's question here leads me to think that this trip is Elijah's choice, Elijah's initiative, not the Lord's. And Elijah's response is, you know, why are you here? I'm the only one left. I'm the only one that cares. I'm the only one. That's always really negative language, right? Whenever anyone talks like that. I'm the only one. I'm the only one doing anything. It's only me. Everyone else sucks. It's just me. I'm the only one, he says. The people have forsaken the covenant. They've torn down the altars. They've killed the prophets. The only one left is me, and they're trying to kill me. Elijah has a distorted perspective, doesn't he? He's half right about many of these things. Yes, Elijah is the only prophet that is left confronting the king and the prophets of Baal, but he's hardly alone. We know that there's been, you know, there's 100 other prophets that are protected in the caves. There's other people that are following God and doing the right thing. And yes, Jezebel's trying to kill him, but his life is in God's hands, not Jezebel's. He's faced worse already in the chapters we've read. And yes, the people have broken the covenant, thrown down the altars, and killed the prophets, but they also just restored their allegiance to Yahweh, rebuilt the altar on Carmel, and killed the prophets of Baal. But he seems to have forgotten everything that happened on Carmel, and he's focused on all the darkness that preceded it. So why is Elijah here? Why is he at the mountain? When he gives this answer, I think his answer, where no one is faithful but me, and I'm about to be killed, I think what he's saying is everyone's broken the covenant. They're never going to repent. It's over. The worship of God is over. I have come to the mountain where it started, the mountain where the covenant began. God, it's time to start again. Elijah, I think, is looking for a Moses experience. God needs to give up on Israel and start again with me. So he goes back to Mount Sinai, where it all started. There's no hope, God. It's just me and they're trying to kill me. It's time we start again. He wants a Moses experience up the mountain. Does God agree with him? Look at verse 11. And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint and prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So, as Elijah is hidden in the cave, perhaps even the same cleft of the rock that Moses was hidden in, when God passed him by. So as Elijah's hidden in that place, the Lord passes by. And he's accompanied by powerful manifestations of his presence, ones that we've associated with God's holy, powerful presence in the past, right? Like on the mountain when God gave the Ten Commandments. These are the types of things that come about with God's presence. A strong wind that breaks apart rocks, breaks them into pieces, and an earthquake, fire. And these are the types of things that happened on Mount Sinai when God was present with his people there. But as powerful as these experiences, as overwhelming as they are, God was not in them. And then comes the sound of a low whisper, verse 12. Now, this is a tricky, tricky phrase, and a lot hinges on what it means. So, if you're reading an ESV, there's a footnote on it, which gives an alternate translation. And the alternate translation they've provided is, "a sound, a thin silence." The KJV, King James Version, famously translated this phrase, "a still small voice." And I think it set the trajectory of Bible translations ever since. And it's led to a whole line of interpretation where we seek to hear God in the quiet stillness of our own heart, and sort of God speaks in quietness is sort of the interpretation we've taken. And I think that's not a good translation or good interpretation of what is meant here. There's three Hebrew words here that we have this phrase from. The first word is a very common word that means voice or sound. The third word is an adjective meaning thin or fine. And the second word, the key word, it only occurs three times in the Hebrew Bible, and it means stillness or silence. And so the words here point to a profound, meaningful silence. So literally, I think it should be translated, "the sound of thin silence." That's literally what it says. So we might say a pregnant pause, a deafening silence, something like that, right? What's the point? Scholar John Woodhouse says, "The silence was profound. There was not going to be a new beginning, a fresh revelation, a plan B to supersede the word of the Lord given in the days of Moses. It was as though the silence, no new word from the Lord, underlined that the Lord was not in the wind, earthquake, and fire, not this time. The Lord may have passed by, but he had nothing to add to the foundational revelation he had given to Moses," end quote. See, I think Elijah's looking for new revelation from God. He wants a Moses-type experience, but God doesn't give it to him. He had no new word to add to his revelation. Elijah has given up on the covenant, but God hasn't. Right? It seems like Elijah says, "Scrap the covenant, let's make a new one." And God says, "No. I have nothing to add or take away from what I've already said. He's already spoken, and it's final." So he hits Elijah not with a new revelation, but with a profound, meaningful silence. And after the silence, right, it says, "Behold, indicating something new. Then the voice of God comes and asks him again, what are you doing here? This is not the still small voice, right? This is God's voice coming after the silence. Behold, that indicates something new. There came a voice. Now comes a voice. And again, Elijah gives the same response as he in verse 14 that he did before. Same question, same response. Shows me nothing has changed. Elijah's perspective has not changed. And so then God gives a further response. He gives some commands to Elijah in verse 15 and 16. Go return. This is Elijah's recommissioning. Okay, get back in the game. Head back. I'm not finished with you. I'm sending you back. Go return. We have work to do, Elijah. I'm not finished, and neither are you. What's he to do when he returns? He's to anoint Hazael to be king over Syria and Jehu over Israel. This is significant. God's plan goes well beyond Ahab. The battle with Baal won't be resolved in this generation, but in the next. But in the next. And he's to anoint Elisha to be prophet in his place. And then there's two promises given to Elijah. The first is that these three swords, that is Hazael, Jehu, and Elisha, right? Verse 17, the three swords will bring justice. They will finish the fight. See, Elijah had hoped that Mount Carmel ended the fight with Baal worship in Israel. It's done, right? We beat them. We win. But it didn't. But it didn't. And Elijah has to be content that the house of Ahab, the line of Ahab, and the worship of Baal will be defeated, but not by him and not in his lifetime. The fight will continue. He has to be content that he has a role to play in this fight. He's going to start this fight, but in God's sovereignty, he's not the one who's going to finish it. He won't finish the job, but he will pass the torch to the next generation, and they will finish it. The house of Ahab will be over. The worship of Baal will end, but it won't be in Elijah's life. He wanted it all to end with this moment, and he was devastated when it didn't. And God says it will, but not through you. You have to be okay with the role you have to play. And now you will appoint the next generation. They will finish the job. They will finish it. The second promise is that there is a faithful remnant. That's in verse 18, right? God corrects Elijah. Elijah's not alone. Elijah's not alone. He feels alone. He's not alone. God has and will preserve a remnant in Israel, 7,000 who have never bowed the knee to Baal, never kissed him. Yes, Israel has broken the covenant, rejected God, chased after other gods, but God has a faithful Israel within Israel. Right? He has a faithful remnant. Elijah's not alone. He is protecting his people. And we see this throughout the Old Testament when the nation rebels and rejects God, there's always a faithful remnant that God preserves. And that remnant is not just Elijah alone. There's thousands that God has protected. Elijah just doesn't see it. God has a lot more going on than Elijah can see. And so he needs to trust that God knows more than him. He needs to trust that there's a bigger picture. So what does Elijah do? Verse 19. He obeys. So he departed from there and found Elisha the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen in front of him. And he was with the 12th. Elijah passed by him and cast his cloak upon him, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you." And he said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" And he returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the yokes of the oxen and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and went after Elijah and assisted him. So Elijah finds Elisha, and Elisha has 12 yoke of oxen, 12 pairs of oxen, and he's a farmer, and he's plowing a field with his oxen. And this tells us that Elisha's a pretty wealthy guy, right? He owns a lot of animals for having been through a major drought. He's farming with all his oxen. This is pretty significant wealth in that time and in that place. And Elijah walks by him, puts his cloak on him, symbolically calling him to the prophetic role, the prophetic office. And just as, same word, just as Elijah runs away from Jezebel, Elisha runs after Elijah. It's really interesting, right? Elisha's eagerness to say yes matches Elijah's eagerness to get out of Dodge. And so it comes full circle. Elisha goes back, kisses his parents goodbye, sacrifices his oxen, gives the food away to the village. It's amazing. Why does he do this? It's a decisive break with his current, now former life. He cut ties with his old life. He burns the bridges. He removes the possibility of going back. There's nothing to go back with. They had a barbecue. It's over. He can't be a farmer again. He's heard the call of God, and he's never going back. This is so important. So important. Because Elisha, like Elijah, will have days where he lives in a deep, dark valley. He will have days of sorrow and despair. He will have days where people are hunting him and his life is on the line. He will have days where he feels like a failure. He will have days that are so hard that he can't go on. And he will yearn for farming, where the oxen do what they're told, and the vegetables grow and they don't talk back, right? And the plants don't try to kill you, and the plants don't have affairs, and the plants don't... Farming's easy, right? There's no sin. It's just plants and weeds and animals. And he'll long for the ease of farming when people are hunting for his life or living in rebellion and disobeying God. And on that day, he won't be able to go back. He's cut ties completely and decisively. He's made it so that he can't go back even if he wanted to. This is a total commitment to the call of God. He's never going back. So, he joins Elijah and assisted him, it says. And the chapter ends with that note. He arose and went after Elijah and assisted him. So at the end, we find Elijah's not alone. What happened? God fed him. God nourished him. God called him to rise. God corrected his wrong thinking. God showed him a glimpse of his sovereign plan. And God gave him a friend and a partner in Elisha. I love that the heroes of the Bible aren't always heroic, right? Their amazing victories are often quickly followed by failure and defeat. This is encouraging in a weird way. The mountaintops quickly give way to valleys. Being perfect is not a prerequisite for being used of God or serving in his ministry. The Bible's not a book of heroes that we need to imitate. Be like Elijah, guys. Call fire from heaven. Do Elijah things. That's not it. It's a story of his grace and mercy to broken sinners. What valleys are you facing today? What causes fear and despair in your life? Think about it. What's the situation that causes darkness in your heart, causes fear, hopelessness? For some, illness gives us an uncertain future, and we want to run in fear. For others, it's like the strain and stress of parenting. It makes us feel like a failure. We can't change these kids. We can't fix these problems. For others, it's our own sin and brokenness that can be so overwhelming and challenging. We just want to give up. For others, there's conflict in our lives that we just can't rid of and stress from that. And it leads us, like, nothing's ever going to change. And we feel like a failure. We feel hopeless. The situation's so hopeless. What causes fear and despair in your life? Where do we turn then when we're feeling hopeless like that? What answer is there when victory turns into loss, when the mountains turn into valleys, when courage gives way to fear? Know this. We have a God who meets us in our dark valleys and gives us what we need to get out of them. He nourishes us. He comforts us. He encourages us. He equips us. He sends us back into the fight, ready for what's coming next. He doesn't attack us or condemn us for our hurt and despair, but strengthens us for what lays ahead. Our struggle doesn't disqualify us from his service, but he restores us and recommissions us like Elijah. He's a God of power and fire and earthquakes and storm. But he's a God of gentleness and tenderness and forgiveness as well. He's a God of the mountaintops. He's a God in the deep, dark valleys. He's the sovereign God over the situations that are right in front of us. And he's the sovereign God over a million situations we know nothing about and couldn't imagine. His world is so much bigger than our little, small, distorted picture of reality. He's got a million other things on the go that shape and redefine the things we're looking at right in front of us. He's with us in our great victories. He's with us in our despair and defeat. And on all these days, God is with us, God is for us, and God is always good to us. This is what we see in Elijah. This is what we know to be true in our own lives.